In 1998, Vern Beachy was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. In 2003, he married the love of his life, but his story took a heartbreaking turn only 3 years later. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Vern Beachy has written about his life and the loss of his wife in the book A Tear-Stained Letter, Surviving Multiple Sclerosis and My Wife's Suicide. Today, I'll talk with him about his experiences. It is also the final day of our spring membership drive, so please take a moment today to invest in the public radio service you depend on at iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Vern Beachy was a successful journalist and a young, strong man when he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1998. Just a few years later, in 2003, he married the love of his life. But just 3 years after that, he lost her. He's written about his life and his loss in the book A Tear-Stained Letter, Surviving Multiple Sclerosis and My Wife's Suicide. And he is here with me today. Hello, Vern.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
In the book, of course, you write a great deal about your late wife, Melinda. When did the two of you meet?
We met back in 1987, so I knew her quite a while before I was diagnosed with MS, and we were together and apart, and you know, my career took me one way and different state and hers another, and we always stayed in touch, though, and eventually got back together for good.
When you met, you were working in radio in Iowa, right?
Yes, I was. I was working in Carroll, Iowa, and I live in Carroll, Iowa now, and that's where we met, and it just went from there.
And in the book, you write that you were waiting for her to you knew she was the right one, and you were waiting for her to figure out the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was it was right for me, and it wasn't right for her at different times, and I knew that's she was the one I wanted, so I was patient in that way. I wasn't until I didn't get married until I was 39 years old.
Well, let's go back to the late 90s. Before you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, you had become really avid at outdoor activities, especially hiking and mountain climbing. What were the first signs that there may be something going wrong?
Well, I was living in Albuquerque at the time, and if anybody has been in Albuquerque, there's this huge mountain on the east side, and I lived in the foothills of that, and I was hiking and stuff. And on the radio, the cerebral palsy association called me and wanted me to do a marathon and do reports on the radio. They would provide a trainer and stuff like that. And I was an avid hiker. I said, no problem, I can do that. One Saturday morning when I started training, it was the first day, got up early, was going to run and see how far I'd go.
Right, and you'd never really been a runner
before,
but you were in good shape.
Yeah, I was. I figured, you know, wrongly so, I'm sure. I figured, well, I'm an avid hiker. You know, running isn't that much different, but it is, you know, different in the fact that and how you train. So I started training, and I started running, and I was just completely exhausted. And whenever I took a step, I felt like I was going to fall over. And so I stopped and looked back, see how far I'd gone. Well, I'd gone a block.
Oh.
And I knew something was wrong.
Right. That was more than just trying to start to be a runner.
Yeah, exactly. I was in good shape, you know. Okay, I figured, you know, 5 miles, I would stop and take a break, but one block, and that was it.
Wow.
I knew something was wrong.
Did you immediately call a doctor?
The next day I did. No, I didn't immediately, and I probably should have, but I went into work the next day, and a coworker looked at me and said, "Looks like you had a stroke, because one side of my face was contorted, and, you know, I wasn't in any pain, but I was just exhausted, and I felt like I was stumbling every walk I took." So I went into my family doctor, and he looked at me up and down, gave me some, you know, touch your finger with your nose and stuff like that, and watched me walk. He says, "You know, I think you have MS, but I'd like to take you and have you go to a neurologist, get an MRI just to confirm my diagnosis."
Well, and at that point, what did you know about MS?
To me, MS was a software giant in the Pacific Northwest. That's how much I knew. Nothing. Nobody I knew had it, so I wasn't familiar with it. And when the doctor looked at my MRI results, he just glanced at me and said, "Yeah, you got MS. He said, "Do you want a shot once a day or once a week?" Well, I'd take the once a week. You know, who wouldn't? I said, for what, a week or two until it clears up, you know, and then I'll be good to go? He said, "No, the rest of your life." So that's how much I didn't know about MS.
Well, and I'm sure everyone has heard of MS, but it's a disease that really takes a different path in every person that it's present in.
Every person, you know, there's similar symptoms with everybody that has MS, but it's different for every person. You know, somebody could be a fast course of the disease, and they have tightening of their chest, which is a symptom called MS hug. I've never had that, but other people have, and it's just different. There are similarities, but every person is different, and I found out that every person reacts differently to the drugs that are now out on the market. When I was diagnosed, there were two. Now there are 10. So it's good, but all of the drugs are just designed to slow down the progression of the disease, because there's no cure for MS.
Now, what were your symptoms? I mean, you mentioned not having endurance when you tried to run, but I'm sure after you were diagnosed, you probably were able to look back and start to see other signs.
I traced my symptoms back 10 years prior to my diagnosis. And what that symptom was in radio, is sitting there, and my girlfriend at the time said, "Do you realize that when you're sitting down," and I did the news, "do you realize when you're sitting down in the studio reading the news, you put the mic up, so you have to look up?" And I said, "Well, that's because when I look down, my hands and arms go numb." And that was, you know, I learned later, the early symptoms of MS. I thought it was a pinched nerve. I said, "Oh, I'll just put the mic up a little bit." So I could trace it back 10 years prior to being diagnosed. And after I was diagnosed, the numbness in my arms and legs and hands and feet got pretty prominent. And I was doing live reports on the radio from the scene of news events, and I couldn't really talk. I sounded like I was drunk on the air. And I knew the facts of the story, but my brain did not really communicate with my mouth, so it sounded like gibberish kind of when it came out. You know, I knew the facts, but I couldn't really tell the listeners what the story was, because it just jumbled between my brain and my mouth. That was another thing. And the fatigue was incredible. It was incredibly bad. An hour or two up and awake was about it, and I had to lay down, and that was one of the big things of, of MS. Plus, I couldn't talk. I sounded drunk on the air, which is not a good thing for
a news director. You describe the mental fog, which is a very common symptom for
Absolutely.
People with MS.
Absolutely. It's, it's really tough for the cognition because some people have it worse than others, but there's always just a little bit of cognition problems with everybody that I know that has MS.
Now, you mentioned that you had known Melinda for quite some time before, over 10 years before you got your diagnosis mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. MS. You were kind of on again, off again. You were waiting for her. How did she respond to your diagnosis of multiple sclerosis?
She kind of viewed it, and I later learned I thought it would turn her off, but she kind of viewed it as, okay, this is kind of my purpose in life, because she was kind of rudderless and didn't know exactly what her purpose in this life, and she always looked for it and tried to find it, and then she thought and told my father later that, yeah, I think my purpose in life is taking care of Vern and being there for him and being with him. So that was how she reacted to MS.
So it's interesting because I can imagine that probably when you were diagnosed, you were worried that you would be a burden on someone
or
maybe just be alone.
Absolutely, because even though I didn't know much about MS, I did know this, or at least I thought this was a fact of life. Everybody that had MS that I knew, that I saw in support groups that I started going to, were in wheelchairs. And I thought that was my, future.
Right.
And I had a coworker tell me in Albuquerque, and she said, and I remember it to this day, and that's why I fought it so much. She said, fight as long as you can going into a wheelchair, because once you get there, you'll never get out. And that was in the back of my mind, and I had fought going into a wheelchair for several years just because of that comment, because I thought that was my fate. And the doctors told me, okay, after your diagnosis, your five-year mark, once you get to the five-year mark, and how you are at that time is probably how you're going to be the rest of your life.
Wow.
And at the five-year mark, I was using a wheelchair. I thought that was my fate.
Now, also at just about that five-year mark, you and Melinda got married.
Yes, we did. And I moved to Memphis and we got married along the Mississippi River. And if everybody asked me, well, let me see your wedding pictures. Well, I have those pictures, but nowhere in those would you see a wheelchair or the crutches I had to use, because I did not want that. But you can tell she held me up as I stood. And I was leaning on her, but nowhere you see the crutches in a chair. And I said, I did not want that. So they weren't there, but she was holding me up. I can tell that, and other people that know me can tell that, yeah, she's holding you up and you're leaning on her. But I was using a chair and crutches at the time. But, I guess I tried to keep those out of the pictures, and I succeeded.
You describe those first 3 years of your marriage, your only 3 years of your marriage,
mm-hmm.
as very happy years
yes.
for the two of you.
Yes.
Although you weren't able to work, and you were struggling a great deal with your health, and Melinda also was struggling.
Yeah, she was. She was dealt with depression, and I knew that. But I didn't realize until afterwards how much she was dealing with that. I had seen signs, but she was always happy-go-lucky, a wonderful wife and wonderful woman. And she knew what I needed before I knew what I needed. That's how I viewed it. And she was pretty protective of me. But I did realize that she dealt with depression. Nothing severe that I thought, but obviously was a lot more than what I realized at the time. I know a whole lot more about her and her condition now afterwards, hindsight being 2020.
Right. Well, we will continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Vern Beachy. He is the author of the book, A Tear-Stained Letter, Surviving Multiple Sclerosis and My Wife's Suicide. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. And coming up in the near future, Vern will be at Cafe Diem in Ames on March 20th for a book signing from 4 to 6 p.m. that day. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest this hour is Vern Beachy. He was a successful journalist, a young, strong man when he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1998. Just 5 years later, in 2003, although his disease continued to debilitate him, he also had the opportunity to marry the love of his life, a very happy marriage, but it lasted for only 3 years. 3 years later, he lost his wife to suicide. And he's written about his life and his loss in the book, A Tear-Stained Letter, Surviving Multiple Sclerosis and My Wife's Suicide. And Vern, just before the break, we had gotten to your marriage. And in your book, you write about the fact that Melinda, at one point, your dad or mom had said something to her about how grateful they were that she was in your life helping mm-hmm. you. And she said to you, yeah, but they don't know how much you helped me.
Yes, absolutely. And it was a give and take. And I knew that she used to be an avid journal writer. And I never read the journals. But she quit writing in a journal after we got married. And I thought things were in her mind, getting on a right track, and she was dealing with sometimes her depression that got to her. But she said, yeah, you helped me more. You know, if your mom and dad knew how much I helped her, they would never say thank you. They, you know, because I was doing just as much as she was doing for me. So that was a good memory.
Let's talk about 2006. And that is the year that you lost Melinda. Mm-hmm. And she had some problems at work, partially because she had to take so many sick days and chose to take sick days so that she could be with you when your health was very poor.
Yeah.
And she lost her job.
Uh-huh. And it was, she was in the hole on sick days and one day I was having bad MS days, which the symptoms of MS are just cranked up, and sometimes I would get out of bed, other times I couldn't get out of bed. And she said, no, I'm staying home from work to help you because this is where I want to be. Well, they had fired her that afternoon because she was taking too many sick days, and told her, well, you're not the sick one. Why can't you come into work? That's what all started it. And later on in the earlier on that evening, a couple of her coworkers invited her to come out to a friend's house and just talk about what happened and discuss, just basically where she goes from here and talk about the events of the day. She wanted me to go with her, and I said no because I could barely get out of bed. I said, you go and talk, and I will see you when you get back. And I remember looking at our car when she backed out of the driveway and went up the street, and that was the last time I saw her.
You knew that she had been drinking.
Yes.
You knew that she was distraught.
Yes.
Although suicide wasn't on your mind.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. There was, no, that was not even, you know, on the radar. And I had later learned that she had called her best friend here in Iowa and talked for quite a bit. And, you know, suicide was not even a possibility, or she never thought that that's what would happen, but it did, and just enough to push her over the edge, I guess. It's hard to think what she was thinking at the time, and I don't know. I can't speculate. Right. I have some ideas, but I wasn't in that moment, and I'm sure it was very absolutely tough, and that was the only option for her at the time.
You watched her go that night. She didn't come back, although you did talk to her on the phone. She said, I promise I'll be home in 15 minutes, but she didn't come home. And in the morning, she still wasn't there. You, although you couldn't physically go look for her, you didn't have two cars, and
no.
Of course, your MS was had put you in a situation where it was very, very difficult to travel and go places. But you started making phone calls, and you started trying to find her.
Absolutely. We had a friend, Melinda's bridesmaid, in her wedding. She was a Memphis police officer. And she suggested I call, you know, the hospitals and stuff. And so I did. And there was nothing. I didn't find anything out. And it'd be quite a while before I knew anything at all, actually.
How long did it take you to learn that she had died?
It wasn't until 11 o'clock that Friday night when two Memphis police officers knocked on my door and told me what had happened. So it was the whole day and the whole afternoon, because I woke up early in the morning, like I usually do, and it wasn't until 11 o'clock that night that I found out what had happened.
At this point, there are two different stories to tell. Of course, there is the story of your incredible grief, and to have someone that you love commit suicide is an unbelievably difficult experience. I don't think anybody could possibly understand it if they haven't been through it. The anger, the guilt, the sadness, the loss. But also, you are a man living with a disability at this time.
Yeah.
And people treat you in a couple of different ways. For one, you didn't find out about your wife's death for many hours after someone else knew, because he didn't want to call you because you had MS.
Yeah, MS. And he told the police officers, the guy, her coworkers, where she was at that night. Coworker told the cops, do not call Vern because he has MS. And I said, where would that even come up in conversation to where protecting me or shielding me from that would play any part in? It just blew me away. I couldn't figure out why that would even play a part in the conversation between he and the police officers. And you know, it worked, because I didn't find out for hours after that.
So you are frantic at home and scared and mm-hmm. lonely and have no idea what's happened to your wife, because this man thinks that you can't mentally handle it.
Yeah.
Because you have a disease.
I have MS.
But
yeah.
Then at the same time, these police officers, these detectives come to your house and they have no understanding of what your disease is.
No, not at all. And they saw me stumble around, and when they told me what had happened, and they didn't have many details because they weren't the investigating officers, and they left that night, but not after calling a friend of mine, or had me call a friend of mine and come over and stay with me. They said, give us a call tomorrow and you come down to the police department headquarters to get some more information and her effects and stuff like that. Well, yeah, I had one crutch at home, didn't have the wheelchair. The other crutch was in the car, and they impounded the car because it was at a scene of an unexplained death. And here I was stuck. And
stranded.
And the headquarters of Memphis Police Department was about 20 miles from where I lived in East Memphis. And the detective was talking with him. He said, "Oh, just come on down. We'll get your effects and get it. It'll take just a few minutes." And I said, I can't get down there. And he said, "Well, Mr. Beachy, you're a young man. Why can't you get down here?" And that was the start, a continuing of not really knowing what I was dealing with not really knowing hardly anything about MS from their standpoint. And that, and later found out, was the start of a day that was quite trying and quite hard to get around the headquarters of the Memphis Police Department, the Homicide Division, where they were investigating. It wasn't a homicide, but it was an unexplained death. So they took that, and they were on the 11th floor of this building. They said, "Well, come on, you know, just come on up. You know, it'd be take 2 minutes." Well, it, you know, takes me about a half hour to get up there, even using the elevator, just because of my disability. And I was dealing with the death of my wife.
Right.
You know, I wasn't really capable of doing much of anything, but they asked me for a lot of things, to do a lot of things. "Well, come on down, you know, just walk down the hall and into the next building, and it'll take 2 minutes."
Right, you had to get your car out of the impoundment, and they had lost the keys, so just come to headquarters
just
and get
come
the
on.
Keys. And
no problem.
And this went on for a long time.
Yes.
And it's you write a lot about that in your book, and it strikes me that this is a point that really, in retrospect, galvanized you into something of an activist for disability rights.
Yes, it did, because I wrote some letters. You know, I couldn't do much afterwards, but I knew that I could write, and I did. And I wrote letters to the mayor of Memphis, the police chief, and senators, just because there was one thing I wanted. I thought, you know, I couldn't bring my wife back. I couldn't change those events, but I could possibly help somebody else in a similar situation as mine, make it easier on them. I said little things like having a wheelchair at the information booth of the Memphis Police Department that would help people who are in situation like mine. But there was no wheelchair. And
one of the officers finally took pity on you and tried to drag you down the hall on an office chair with posters.
Yes. And two female deputies. I remember when I was walking to this property room that the detective said I had to walk to, and I had one crutch, and I was leaning on the wall, and I was exhausted, and two female deputies came up and rushed to me and grabbed me before I fell down. And they said, asked the officer, "Why are you treating him this way?" And I said, "Well, hang on, I'll go get a chair." And this officer went into the next room. I thought, finally, somebody is going to go and get a wheelchair to help me, because obviously I was to the point of where I could barely walk. Well, he didn't come back with a wheelchair. He came back with one of these office chairs, you know, with the rollers on them. He said, "Have a seat and I'll pull you down to the property room." Well, and I looked at him. I was, "Are you kidding me?" But I had no choice. I had to sit there because I could barely stand at that point. So I sat down. And he pulled me down the hall, me holding a crutch, He pulled me in this office chair and went into the next building. We had to go and cross the, and they had decorative brick on the sidewalk, and the chair almost tipped over, and he said, "Well, come on, you know, it's just a few minutes, you know, not long." And finally, I put my feet out. I stopped. I says, "I cannot go on this any longer." "Well, why?" And he didn't have a clue. It was humiliating, like I was a kid at a school and sitting in the corner with a dunce cap. That's what I felt like.
And well, and I'm sure that's a feeling many people with disabilities can relate to. You know, Vern, you write so beautifully about your grief and trying to move through this fog that you were left in, both with grief and, of course, stress actually makes MS much worse. So you were struggling even more physically. You decide to move to Iowa.
Yes.
And again, I mean, at this point, you weren't able to work, but you moved to Iowa because you wanted to be closer to where Melinda was buried.
Yes.
And I was struck, you reached out in many beautiful ways. I mean, reaching out to a therapist, support groups. You had a lot of talks with Melinda. You wrote her a lot of beautiful letters. You also really found a community online with posting videos that showed your grief and your love.
Yeah. And it started, you know, I thought, well, I want to show people what Melinda meant to me and what our marriage meant to me. And the only way I knew how to do it is write. And I got on YouTube and started a channel, and I did these video tributes to her. And the response from that, from not only, you know, total strangers and her family, was profound. And I didn't realize how much it meant to them, I guess, but also to me, they were easy to do, but very tough. But it meant a lot to them, and I appreciated that. And the channel grew, and now into the MS community and dealing with that. And so I've been doing it. After Melinda died, I started a YouTube channel just to do video tributes to her. I thought that's how I can express my feelings, and hopefully that will help her family know, and it'll help me therapeutically too.
Right. Well, you also, just shortly, 6 months after her death, had an amazing physical breakthrough. You mentioned that there are a number of different drugs available for multiple sclerosis. They don't work for everyone.
Yeah.
But you started on a drug treatment that has worked wonders for you.
Wonders. I started it in November of 06. And Melinda and I had been going to MS support groups in Memphis when we started hearing about this miracle drug coming out for MS. And my health was declining, and I was taking drug after drug, different drugs, and I would fail on them because they wouldn't really do anything for me. And I started in November of 06, and it's a monthly infusion of this drug, and got it the first time, and nothing. I felt nothing. It didn't help, didn't hurt, but I felt nothing, and 30 days after that, same thing, nothing. You know, a month after that, for my third infusion, nothing. But it all changed that next day, the day after my third infusion.
And I wanted to have you read a little bit of that, but we're nearly out of time. So just tell me what happened. You got up that morning, early morning, to go to the bathroom. What happened?
Nothing happened. A lot happened. I went to the bathroom and went back to my bed, and I stopped in my tracks, and it was not what had happened, but what had not happened. I had not touched the walls to keep myself up. I had not stumbled. I had not fallen down. And I was standing there next to my bed, perfectly still. I wasn't shaking. I wasn't swaying like I was going to fall down. I didn't feel like I was going to fall down. And I was walking. It was normal. I was walking. And I went out, left my apartment. I said, I'm going to try this out. I needed some milk at the convenience store. So I left my apartment, first time in 8 years without a cane or crutches or wheelchair. Got into my car, went to the convenience store, got some milk, paid for it, walked back. And before I got into my car, I was looking around to see if anybody was looking and pointing at me. Said, look at what he's doing. Well, nobody was, because I was doing something normal, walking.
Wow.
And like a normal person.
You continue to feel better. I mean, you write about taking a walk, a mile-long walk with your pug every morning and a mile-long walk with your pug every night. Are you still feeling that good? Are you still that healthy?
I am not walking as far. And it's because the disease is progressing. I know that, and the tests show it. But I'm still not using a cane or crutches or a wheelchair. And I think my baseline is whether or not I'm in a wheelchair. That's my marker. Not walking as well. It's tougher now to walk, and I know that. But I'm still not in a wheelchair, so I feel good about that.
You've also built a life, a new life, without Melinda. You are working again. You are married again. Congratulations.
Yes.
What, you poured out so much grief, so much heartache in this book. Was that therapeutic for you to express it?
Totally. Absolutely. Because when I first started writing it, I was thinking, you know, this will be good for me, but what if it's bad for me? But I kept writing. I thought if it was bad for me, I would have stopped writing. But absolutely it is. It was therapeutic for me, and it helped me tremendously. I can't really express how much I feel it has helped me. You know, just expressing my thoughts and feelings and how I was hurt and will continue to be that way for the rest of my life. But yet I am moving on, because I've done things that I told my father a month or two after Melinda died that I would never do. You know,
I said
I'd never laugh again, but I have.
And you thought you'd never love again either.
Yes.
I'm sure your book will also help many others. Vern, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Charity. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Vern Beachy is the author of A Tear-Stained Letter, Surviving Multiple Sclerosis and My Wife's Suicide. He'll be doing a book signing at Cafe Diem in Ames on March 20th from 4 to 6 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.